All right, everyone, get ready, because today we are diving deep, and I mean deep, into a Supreme Court case that really stirs things up. Yasser Hamdi v. Rumsfeld.
Oh, yeah, this one is a big one. It gets right to the heart of some really, really heavy questions about presidential power and citizen rights.
Exactly, and how those two things, you know, bump up against each other in the whole war on terror context.
It's messy, for sure.
Really messy. So, just to set the stage for everyone listening, here's the situation. 9/11 happens.
Oh, yes.
The country's in shock, right?
Absolutely.
And in response, Congress passes the Authorization for Use of Military Force, which most people just call the AUMF.
Right.
Now picture this. Right in the middle of all of this chaos, we've got Yasser Hamdi, a U.S. citizen who was captured in Afghanistan. And the U.S. government basically says, you know what, we think you're an enemy combatant.
And that term, enemy combatant, it's significant, to say the least. I mean, that label is powerful. It basically becomes the government's reason, their justification for holding someone indefinitely, maybe even forever, without a trial.
Without a trial.
Yeah. And just because, in their view, this person is a threat to national security, even if they're a citizen.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what happened to Hamdi. Military prison, no communication with the outside world, no lawyer. And that's really what this whole case boils down to. Can the government actually do that? Do they have the authority to just lock up a citizen, maybe forever, without giving them their day in court?
A huge question, and one that leads to a lot of debate. And, you know, what makes Hamdi v. Rumsfeld even more interesting is that the Supreme Court didn't just come back with a simple yes or no.
Oh, of course not. It's the Supreme Court.
Right. What we get is a whole bunch of different opinions. A majority opinion, then two dissents, and then a concurrence on top of that.
Yeah.
So we've got multiple perspectives on this very complex situation, all coming from different legal minds.
Okay, so a buffet of legal opinions. Let's start with the main course.
Yeah.
Justice O'Connor's majority opinion. What's her take on this whole enemy, combatant, and detention thing? Well, the majority, led by O'Connor, they actually agree that, yeah, in this post-9/11 world, the government does have the power to detain enemy combatants. And that power applies to citizens, too.
Even citizens? Wow.
Yeah. And they're basing this on the AUMF, that resolution passed by Congress. But, and it's a big but, they also say that due process still has to be followed.
Okay, so even with that enemy combatant label attached to them, a citizen can't just be, like, thrown into a legal void.
Nope. O'Connor makes it very, very clear. Any U.S. citizen who's being held as an enemy combatant has to be told why they're being detained. What's the actual basis for it? They also have to have a real chance to challenge those accusations, you know, the government's reasons, in front of someone neutral.
So not just some military official who's going to automatically side with the government.
Right. Now, the court does say that maybe the process needs to be adjusted a little bit during wartime. For example, they say hearsay evidence, which normally wouldn't be allowed in court, might be okay in this situation.
Hold on. Can we back up for a second? For those of us who aren't lawyers, what exactly is hearsay evidence? Why isn't it usually allowed in court?
Sure. Hearsay is basically secondhand information. Like, imagine someone testifying about something they heard someone else say, not something they personally witnessed.
Okay.
It's considered less reliable because you can't, you know, directly question the original source.
Got it. So is the court saying they're basically lowering the bar for what counts as good evidence because it's wartime?
It's sort of like that, yeah. They even say that it's okay to start by assuming the government's evidence is true, but, and this is important, that presumption has to be what we call rebuttable. The person who's detained, they have to have a genuine opportunity to prove the government wrong.
So even though there's some flexibility because of the situation, wartime and all, those core principles of due process, they're still essential.
Absolutely. They're non-negotiable. Even with this war on terror going on, a citizen's rights don't just vanish. And that's a key point from O'Connor's opinion.
Okay, so we've got O'Connor and the majority saying due process still matters, even in this context. But, you know, this case was controversial, and there are definitely some strong disagreements. Let's talk about Justice Scalia. He's not exactly known for holding back, so what's his position on all of this?
Well, as you might expect, Scalia comes out swinging hard. He's completely against the idea that the AUMF, that resolution from Congress, is actually enough to allow for this kind of indefinite detention.
So he thinks Congress basically gave the executive branch a blank check.
Oh, Scalia would say not even close. He argues that the government basically has only two legitimate options when they're dealing with a citizen they believe is fighting against the U.S.
Okay, what are the options?
Option one, They charge them with a crime, like treason, and give them a trial in a civilian court. Option two, they get Congress to officially suspend habeas corpus, which, by the way, the Constitution does allow for during times of rebellion or invasion.
Right, habeas corpus. That's the right to challenge your detention in court, to basically say, hey, I'm being held unlawfully.
Exactly. And Scalia's whole point is that if you're not going to formally accuse them of a crime, then Congress has to step up and very clearly say, yes, you can detain this person without trial. He thinks the AUMF is way too vague, too open-ended to justify something as serious as locking someone up indefinitely.
So he's seeing this whole thing as a power grab by the president.
Absolutely. He views it as a really dangerous overreach by the executive branch, a threat to the very foundations of American freedom.
And you mentioned earlier that Scalia goes way back, all the way to the Founding Fathers, when he's talking about habeas corpus. Why is that history so important to him?
It's fascinating how he uses history to make his point. Scalia digs deep into the history of habeas corpus and shows how the Founding Fathers considered it absolutely essential. It was their safeguard against the government just throwing people in jail and, like, forgetting about them.
A really important right, then. Not something to be messed with lightly.
Exactly. And for Scalia, the majority opinion is messing with it by allowing this broad resolution about military force, the AUMF, to be used as justification for something as drastic as indefinite detention.
Got it. So Scalia draws a clear line. Charge them or suspend habeas corpus. No middle ground. Now, we've also got another dissent, Justice Thomas, and he tends to take a, let's just say, a more generous view of executive power.
That's one way to put it. Thomas actually takes the complete opposite position from Scalia. He thinks the president has a very wide-ranging inherent authority to detain enemy combatants during wartime. And this is where it gets even more interesting. He believes the courts shouldn't interfere at all.
Wow. A total hands-off approach. What's the reasoning there?
He really leans on the president's role as commander-in-chief, and he argues that when national security is at risk, especially during a war, individual liberties sometimes have to take a back seat. It's like he's saying, look, the president needs to be able to act fast, even if those actions are later questioned.
So individual rights are less important when national security is involved.
That's essentially his argument. He even brings up cases like Moyer v. Peabody, which was about what a governor could do during a crisis.
Interesting.
He's basically saying, look, in times of war, the president gets to make the tough calls, even if later on people say those calls were wrong.
Wow. Okay. So we've got two very different perspectives from Scalia and Thomas, right? One, prioritizing individual rights, and the other saying a strong executive is what we need, especially during war.
It's a classic tension, a clash of principles that you see throughout constitutional law, and this case really brings it to the forefront.
For sure. Now, we've got the majority opinion and those two dissents, but we've also got one more voice to consider, Justice Souter's concurrence dissent. What's his take on all of this?
Well, Souter actually agrees with the majority on a really important point. Citizens who are detained as enemy combatants definitely have the right to due process, but he breaks away from the majority because he doesn't believe the AUMF on its own is actually enough to allow for that kind of detention.
So on that point, he's siding with Scalia.
Yeah, you can say that. Souter wants Congress to be super clear, to explicitly say, yes, you can detain citizens as enemy combatants. The AUMF, as it's written, just doesn't do that for him.
Okay, so he's not saying it's never okay to detain a citizen, but Congress has to be way more specific about authorizing it.
Exactly. And Souter doesn't stop there. He also questions whether the U.S. is actually living up to the Geneva Conventions in how it's treating detainees, especially the ones from the Taliban.
Ah, the Geneva Conventions. Those international agreements that set the rules for how prisoners of war should be treated, right?
Well, got it. And Souter points to the specific rule that says even if there's doubt about whether someone's a combatant or not, you have to treat them as a prisoner of war until a tribunal can make a decision. He seems to be suggesting that maybe the U.S. isn't doing that in this case.
So another layer of complexity on top of what's already a complicated situation.
Oh, for sure. This case just keeps unfolding. Souter's concurrence dissent really adds a whole new dimension to the conversation. It highlights the tension that exists between our own domestic laws, international agreements, and then the real-world difficulties of wartime detention.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've gone through the various opinions, all the arguments for and against the government's ability to detain citizens as enemy combatants.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, what actually happened to Hamdi himself? Was he just stuck in this legal limbo forever?
He wasn't, actually. After a bunch of legal wrangling back and forth, Hamdi was released in 2004 and deported to Yemen.
To Yemen?
Yeah, the country where he was born.
But wait, deported even though he was a U.S. citizen?
Yeah, and there's a catch. As part of the deal to be released, he had to renounce his U.S. citizenship and agree not to sue the government for holding him all that time.
Wow. Talk about adding insult to injury, right? He gets his freedom, but at a pretty steep price.
Definitely a controversial ending to a super complicated case, that's for sure.
It makes you think, huh? But before we get too sidetracked, I want to go back to something we were talking about earlier. This whole enemy combatant idea. We've been using the term a lot, but what does it even mean legally? Is there a clear definition, or is it one of those I know it when I see it's things?
That's actually part of the problem with this whole case. The government was really vague about exactly how they decide if someone's an enemy combatant or not.
So how do they explain it?
Their argument was basically that in Hamdi's case, it meant someone who was fighting with or supporting forces that were against the U.S. or its allies in Afghanistan, and that he had been directly involved in attacks on U.S. forces there.
Okay, so pretty broad. But they must have had some evidence to back up their claim that Hamdi fit that description, right?
They did. They gave the court what's called the Mobbs Declaration. It was basically a statement from a Defense Department official saying that Hamdi had gone to Afghanistan, gotten weapons training from the Taliban, and surrendered with a Taliban unit.
And that's where that hearsay issue comes in, right? Because the official who wrote that statement wasn't actually there to see any of that themselves.
You got it. They were just relaying information from other sources.
And the lower courts were fine with that.
At first, yeah. They were pretty willing to defer to the government. It was like, hey, we're in a war. We have to trust what the military is telling us. But O'Connor and the majority on the Supreme Court, they weren't so sure. They said, wait a minute, even during wartime, we can't just take the government's word for it without any questions asked. Due process means Hamdi gets a chance to challenge that evidence.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But what kind of evidence could Hamdi even use to argue against what the government was saying? Especially if he was captured on a battlefield. That seems almost impossible.
That is the million-dollar question, and it's one of the things that makes this case so fascinating. O'Connor doesn't spell out exactly what a successful rebuttal would have to include, but she throws out some ideas.
Like what?
Well, for example, Hamdi could argue that he wasn't actually fighting. Maybe he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, like his father claimed.
So like an accidental tourist defense. I don't know if a judge would buy that.
It would be a tough sell for sure, especially with everyone on high alert after 9/11. But the point is, he deserved a chance to make his case. And that chance had to be real, not just some fake trial where the outcome was already decided.
Right. And that brings us back to the neutral decision maker. Who would that even be in this kind of situation? A regular court.
That's another one of the big unanswered questions the case leaves us with. O'Connor suggests that a military tribunal, if it's set up properly and authorized the right way, might be okay constitutionally. But she also doesn't rule out the possibility of a civilian court stepping in if it's necessary to guarantee due process.
So a few different options depending on the situation.
Right. That flexibility might be necessary to deal with how unique these enemy combatant cases are. You're trying to balance the government's legitimate need to protect classified information and make sure military operations aren't getting bogged down with lawsuits and the fundamental rights of citizens, which can't be ignored even during wartime.
What a balancing act, huh? And I bet this is where Justices Thomas and Scalia would have even more to say.
Oh, absolutely. Thomas would likely argue that any involvement by the courts in these matters just isn't right, that it's stepping on the president's toes when it comes to wartime powers. And Scalia, he'd probably insist on a full-blown trial in a civilian court with all the traditional due process protections.
Two very different viewpoints. So the majority opinion is somewhere in the middle.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that it wasn't just O'Connor who thought this way. Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices Kennedy and Breyer all signed on to the majority opinion, too.
So a pretty big group on the court agreed with this approach. But even with this majority opinion, does it really change anything? Did it have any teeth?
That's always the challenge with these big Supreme Court cases. They set a legal example, but then it's up to lower courts, lawmakers, and even future Supreme Courts to figure out how to actually apply that example to real-world situations.
And those real-world situations can get messy fast, especially when you're dealing with national security and individual rights. But I'm still a little confused. O'Connor says the AUMF allows for detention, but also that Hamdi couldn't be held forever. How did those two things work together.
That's where Justice Souter's concurrence dissent becomes really important. Remember, he agreed with the due process argument, but he insisted that the AUMF itself wasn't enough to hold Hamdi in the first place.
Right. He wanted Congress to be way more clear about giving the okay for detentions.
And O'Connor seems to agree with him, at least indirectly. She emphasizes that detention can't go on for longer than active fighting is happening. She even calls this a clearly established principle of the law of war.
So once the fighting stops, there's no reason to keep holding someone.
That's the idea. Of course, in a global war on terror, figuring out when the fighting is actually over, that's a whole other problem.
Yeah, we could talk about that for hours. But even if we could somehow magically define that moment, the question remains, what happens to those enemy combatants then? Do they just get to walk free?
That's one of the big unanswered questions hanging over Hamdi v. Rumsfeld. It puts some safeguards in place for citizens who are called enemy combatants, but it doesn't really tell us what happens after that.
It's a case that clarifies some things, but also creates a bunch of new legal and policy puzzles.
That's the Supreme Court for you. It reminds us that law is often a messy process that keeps evolving. It's a back and forth between the different parts of government with different interpretations and attempts to balance competing interests.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier that Justice Souter brought up the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah.
How do those international rules fit into this whole discussion?
Well, remember, one of Souter's big concerns was whether the U.S. was actually following its obligations under the Geneva Conventions when it came to treating detainees, particularly those captured during the fight with the Taliban.
Right.
He highlights a key part of the Geneva Conventions that says even when there's doubt about whether someone is a combatant or not, you're supposed to treat them as a prisoner of war until a competent tribunal can make a decision.
So kind of like an innocent until proven guilty approach.
Yeah.
But for figuring out if someone's a prisoner of war.
Precisely. And Souter points out that this tribunal process is actually laid out in a U.S. military regulation. It involves a hearing with certain safeguards, like the right to present evidence and question witnesses.
Sounds pretty straightforward. What's the problem then?
Well, the Bush administration took the position that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply to Taliban fighters because they argued the Taliban wasn't a traditional state military.
They were trying to find a loophole.
That's how many legal experts saw it, yeah. And it gets to one of the core tensions of the war on terror. How do you take legal frameworks designed for a traditional war and apply them to a fight against a non-state actor like Al-Qaeda?
It's like the Bush administration was trying to change the rules of the game.
They were definitely pushing the boundaries, and that had major consequences for how detainees were treated. If the government didn't see them as prisoners of war, then they wouldn't have the same protections under the Geneva Conventions.
Makes sense. It makes you question whether the whole detention process was even legal to begin with.
Exactly. And that's what Souter seems to be hinting at in his concurrence dissent. He's not directly saying the U.S. violated the Geneva Conventions, but he's definitely raising questions about whether the government was meeting its obligations, especially this requirement to have a tribunal to figure out someone's status.
So we're adding even more legal and ethical complexity to this already complicated case. It makes you wonder what Congress was doing during all this. Did they ever weigh in on the Geneva Conventions issue?
Well, this is where things get even more tangled. Remember, after 9/11, Congress was under a lot of pressure to do something quickly and decisively. There was so much fear and uncertainty, and a lot of people felt like the old rules didn't apply anymore.
So they were giving the executive branch a lot of leeway.
That's how a lot of critics saw it, yeah. And that atmosphere made it really hard to have any kind of meaningful debate about what the war on terror meant legally and ethically. Even members of Congress who had concerns about what the Bush administration was doing, they were afraid to speak up. They didn't want to be called unpatriotic or soft on terrorism.
So basically, fear was shutting down dissent and any kind of critical thinking.
Exactly. And that's a dangerous situation for any democracy. It creates a situation where the executive branch can just act on its own without any real checks and balances.
That's what worries me the most about this enemy combatant label. If the government can just lock up a citizen indefinitely, no trial, based on vague criteria and evidence they don't have to reveal, what's stopping them from doing it again and again?
That's the question that keeps legal scholars and civil liberties advocates up at night. Hamdi v. Rumsfeld set some limits, but as we've seen, those limits aren't always clear or easy to enforce.
So it's a case that provides some answers, but also opens up a ton of new legal and policy questions. It shows how hard it is to define where executive power ends, especially in times of crisis.
And it's a good reminder that we can't take our freedoms for granted. They're fragile, and they can be eroded if we're not paying attention.
Absolutely. We can't just assume our rights will always be there. We have to constantly work to make sure they're secure. But speaking of concrete action, did Hamdi V. Rumsfeld actually lead to any real changes in how the government handles these enemy combatant detentions? Or was it just a lot of talk?
It's kind of a mixed bag, really. On the one hand, yeah, the case did make a difference. I mean, the government had to start, you know, giving detainees more information about why they were being held, and it had to give them some way to challenge those reasons.
So no more just disappearing into this legal black hole.
Right, exactly. And the case also led to the creation of these things called combatant status review tribunals.
Catchy.
Yeah, CSRTs for short, which were meant to provide a more official process for deciding whether someone actually met the definition of an enemy combatant.
Okay, so trying to bring some structure and due process into the system.
Right, but here's the thing. These CSRTs were still run by the military.
Oh.
And critics said they were missing a lot of those basic due process protections that you would expect in a regular civilian court.
Like what? What were they missing?
Well, a big one was the right to a lawyer. Detainees were allowed to have a personal representative at their CSRT hearing, but this person, this representative, didn't have to be a lawyer.
Okay.
And they didn't have the same powers that a lawyer would have, you know, to present evidence or question witnesses.
So, yeah, kind of a step forward, but still not really the full due process that O'Connor seemed to be talking about, in her opinion.
Yeah, that's how a lot of legal experts saw it. They saw these CSRTs as more of a temporary fix, a way for the government to look like it was following the rules without actually changing the power dynamics all that much.
So basically a way to say, see, we're being fair, while still keeping most of the control.
Some people would definitely say so, especially as more and more information came out about what was going on at places like Guantanamo Bay and other detention facilities.
Right, because even if you have a more formal process for labeling someone an enemy combatant, it doesn't really address the bigger issue, right? Is indefinite detention even legal? Is it ethical?
Absolutely. And those questions are still being debated today. I mean, the war on terror continues to evolve. And those lines, you know, the legal and ethical ones, they just keep getting blurrier.
Yeah. It's a sobering reminder that just because you win a legal battle, it doesn't mean the fight for justice is over. It's often just the beginning.
Exactly. And we can't get complacent, you know. The fight for individual rights and liberties never really ends. It takes constant work. Mm. We all have to stay engaged and aware.
Okay, so we've talked about a lot, the legal arguments, the historical context, all the political stuff, but I want to take a step back for a minute and think about the big picture. If someone was listening to this deep dive and they could only take away a few key points, what would those be? What are the most important things to remember about this case?
I think one of the biggest takeaways is that this balance between freedom and safety, it's really delicate.
Yeah.
And it gets even more complicated when there's a war or a national crisis. Hamdi V. Rumsfeld shows us that even in those extreme situations, a citizen's basic rights don't just disappear.
Yeah, there's that saying, right? The Constitution doesn't get put on hold just because there's a war.
Exactly. And the court in Hamdi, while they acknowledge that the government needs some leeway in wartime, they reaffirmed that due process is still essential. It applies even to people who are labeled enemy combatants.
So in a way, it's a victory for individual rights, even if it's not a perfect one.
I think you could definitely see it that way. It's a reminder that the courts have a really important job to do to protect those rights, especially when the other branches of government are so focused on national security.
It's that checks and balances thing we always hear about, right?
That's it. And that brings us to the second big takeaway. Just because the government says it needs broad powers for national security, those powers still have limits. The courts can and should challenge those claims, especially when those claims could hurt the basic rights of citizens.
So the courts are like a check on executive power, making sure it doesn't go too far.
I think that's a good way to put it. Hamdi V. Rumsfeld is a cautionary tale about the dangers of letting the executive branch have too much power, especially during a crisis.
Like that saying, right? Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Exactly. And that leads us to the third takeaway. How we define terms like enemy combatant, it really matters. The fact that this term was so vague, without clear criteria, created a situation where the government could potentially detain someone indefinitely based on evidence they didn't have to disclose.
And the person being detained had basically no way to fight back.
Yeah, it's rough. So this case really highlights the need for more transparency and precision in how we use language, especially when we're talking about justifying these really serious actions. How we define these terms has real-world consequences. You know, it impacts people's lives.
Definitely. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the legal and constitutional parts of this case, but it's important to remember the human side of it, too. This isn't just about abstract legal concepts. It's about real people, people like Yasir Hamdi, who got caught up in this whole war on terror machine.
Right. You can't forget that. It's easy to get lost in the legal details. But this case is about people's lives. It's about how these policies affect individuals and their families in a very real way.
And it's a reminder that even when someone is labeled an enemy combatant, they're still human, deserving of dignity and respect.
Absolutely. That's a core principle we should never forget, both as individuals and as a country.
Now, earlier you mentioned that Hamdi v. Rumsfeld raised more questions than it answered. So what are some of those questions, the ones that we still need to grapple with as a society?
I think one of the biggest ones is, how do we keep that balance between security and individual rights in this ongoing war on terror? The threat is still out there, and governments will have to figure out how to deal with it.
So the tension between liberty and security, it's not going away anytime soon.
It's probably going to be with us for a while, yeah. The real challenge is figuring out how to navigate that tension in a way that reflects our values, our constitution, our commitment to human rights.
And how do we actually decide who gets called an enemy combatant? I mean, the court in Hamdi gave some general guidelines, but there's still a lot of ambiguity when it comes to putting those guidelines into practice.
Yeah, that's another area where we need more clarity for sure. What kind of evidence should be allowed? How much due process is enough to make sure detainees' rights are protected, while also acknowledging that the government has legitimate security concerns? Tough questions, but important ones.
And then I think the biggest question of all, even if we say someone is an enemy combatant, is it ever okay to hold them indefinitely without a trial, possibly for the rest of their life?
That's probably the toughest, most controversial question that comes out of Hamdi v. Rumsfeld. It really makes us think about what it means to be a free society, you know? What are the limits of government power, and what are the ethical implications of what we do? There are no easy answers to that.
Definitely not. But it's a conversation we need to keep having. Hamdi v. Rumsfeld reminds us that the pursuit of justice, it's not a one-time thing, it's an ongoing process.
That's so true.
And it requires us to keep questioning our assumptions, challenging the status quo, working toward a future where security and freedom can coexist.
I love that, and I think that's a great place to wrap up our deep dive into this case. It's a case that's worth revisiting, debating, thinking about. If anyone wants to learn more, we've included links to the source material in the show notes.
And we hope you'll keep the conversation going, too. Share your thoughts. Talk about these issues with people in your community. Because in the end, the future of our democracy depends on citizens who are informed and engaged.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll be back next time with another fascinating topic.